Welcome to the Jerusalem Post podcast. I'm Yaakov Katz, and joined, as usual and always, by Lahav Harkov. And Lahav, I'm curious if you saw Netanyahu, the incoming prime minister-elect, on Meet the Press the other day.
Yes, and it was an interesting interview.
But it wasn't the Israeli Meet the Press.
No. Well, I will say the American Meet the Press is a lot more civil. It's a one-on-one interview mostly. In Israel, there's a lot more shouting. But no, definitely not the Israeli Meet the Press.
But what's interesting, Lahav, is that Netanyahu, since he's received the mandate from President Herzog to form a coalition, he's working on it, and it seems that he might be on track to swear in his new government possibly next week if he can close up with the final outstanding parties that have yet to sign a coalition agreement. But he's been talking a lot to the U.S. or American media, but not a word to anyone here in Israel.
Right. And the thing is, he's obviously promoting his book, right? Every interview he does, they mention his book. But he's still, prime minister designate. He's going to be prime minister in 5 minutes. We have a lot of questions for him. There's a lot of concerns from, at least in the mainstream media of Israel, there are concerns. And even if he doesn't want, if he wants to talk to right-wing media, that's okay too. But, he should be answering the questions that Israelis care about and not just the questions Americans care about. And I was listening to the radio this morning, and they were talking about, that the headlines in the U.S. are Netanyahu : anti-Semitism is the world's oldest hatred. And they were like, okay, where's the news there? Why is that a headline? Now, for me, as someone who's, American, Israeli, and follows the news in English, I get why that's a headline. But Israelis right now care about the political issues of our country.
Right. And one of those political issues happens to be a man by the name of Avi Maoz from the party Noam, which is a faction in the religious Zionist party. And he...
Yeah, speaking of Netanyahu's book, he gets a mention in there, too.
Does he?
Well, he used to basically be the head of the Free Soviet Jewry movement in Israel.
Right.
And he was mentioned in that context, but that was a long time ago. Anyway, go on.
Yes, Avi Maoz, who was a warrior on behalf of Soviet Jewry and became very close to Natan Sharansky, and then actually served as the director general of the Interior Ministry when Natan Sharansky, the famous Jewish hero and refusenik, became the Minister of Interior. A number, maybe it was 25 years ago or something like that. But Avi Maoz since then has embarked on what can only be described as an extreme radical far right journey that has taken him into places where he likes to talk about how he will cancel gay pride parades, how he will change the education system and take out sex ed and gender ed and all this other stuff, how he thinks women need to remain at home and just be involved in childbearing, and more great, wonderful, progressive ideas. So according to the coalition agreement that he signed with the incoming Prime Minister Netanyahu, he will be appointed a deputy minister in the Prime Minister's office with responsibility over Jewish identity, Lahav, right?
Yeah, and when that was signed, it didn't sound like such a... people find reasons to be outraged all the time, but it didn't sound like such a big thing. But then it turned out that what he's actually in charge of is basically approving all external contractors that work within the education system. And the way a lot of things in Israel work, and including the education system, is that there are a lot of external contractors that work. Basically any school that has an assembly that's not just kids putting on a show and is some sort of special educational content, it comes from an external contractor. So he's going to be in charge of what it turns out to be a lot of content for schools, and people are worried that he's going to reject things that, at least for secular schools, are considered part of the norm. And I would say, this whole thing with the external contractors started, I think it was about 15 years ago. And there's been controversy since then, because you say would have schools that have, breaking the silence, which is an extreme left organization that basically accuses the IDF of committing war crimes, right? And so people would say, well, it's not legal to have someone come to school and discourage people from enlisting in the IDF, because one of the purposes of education, according to Israeli law, is to encourage people to enlist in the IDF, little known fact. And he's going to be coming from a different direction of probably canceling any LGBT content, among other things.
It's a program called GEFN, which runs under the education ministry and has thousands, like you said, of different programs. But, nonprofits, NGOs have been coming into schools for decades in Israel. They do it in the Haredi school system. They do it in the national religious system. And they do it, of course, also in the secular system. And some of these programs can be anything from teaching yoga to meditation to mindfulness to healthy eating, but also, yes, gender education, sex education, LGBTQ education, and things along those lines, which are the more controversial programs that definitely for Avi Maoz, but it's raised the wrath or ire of many different heads of councils and mayors throughout the country who have said they won't work with this guy, right? And even some of them, interestingly enough, supporters of Netanyahu who have come out against him. I mean, do you think, Lahav, that this could really lead to something bigger or greater in terms of rebellion from within the ranks of the Likud party, or it'll just pass?
Like, I think education is one of the few places in the Israeli system where the local government actually has a lot of power. Like, construction and planning is probably the other place, but the so it's sort of like, I think that they're going to have to come to some sort of agreement in order to proceed, in order to have any of this kind of special, special is not the word because in education that means something else, but at the out of at any of these external sort of educational content, which is part of the which is what all schools do in Israel, they're going to have to figure something out, because on the one hand, the money and the sort of bank of thousands of options co will be coming from Maoz. And on the other hand, the schools are angry with him. Now, he can't force schools to teach things. Again, like the schools decide, or the municipal education committee decides, but he can take away things, and that's problematic enough. So I don't think the civil disobedience may have to lead him to compromise. Or, as he said in an interview just last week, he said if he can't do what he wants to do, he'll quit. So maybe that's what it'll do.
Maoz will quit, not
Yeah.
Netanyahu,
No,
right?
Maoz.
By the way, the fact that we've been speaking about this now for a number of minutes is exactly why Netanyahu does not want to interview with the Israeli media, because we're going to ask him these types of questions as opposed to what, and with all due respect to Chuck Todd on Meet the Press, asking him about what do you think about Donald Trump having lunch with Kanye West, right? I mean, with all due respect to Netanyahu, I don't really care what he thinks about Donald Trump having lunch with Kanye West at a time that he's establishing a very far right coalition, right? Which is much more important to the state of Israel at the
I
moment.
realize it's more important to the state of Israel, but you know what? This is not what we planned, but we have to talk about Kanye West's impression of Netanyahu. Did you see that?
I did with the, what was it, like a net, a stick,
He
and a
had a
net?
net and a bottle of Yoo-hoo, the chocolate milk. And then he was like, speaking in a voice like this, which of course,
Yes.
whatever. And then he
I
said he
control the
only heard about
banks. I control
Netanyahu.
this. Right.
Yeah, and then he said he only heard of Netanyahu 2 weeks ago. Really intelligent person, and he's running for president. So, I could only laugh because it's all very disturbing. But I actually asked Netanyahu's office if they had a reaction to Kanye West, and first they were like, "What did he say?" Because I think when I asked them that the live stream from Alex Jones was still going on, like it was very new, and then they never sent a reaction. But I was I mean, it wasn't just the Netanyahu thing. The whole thing, I was just like laughing. It was one of these, like, you have to laugh, otherwise you're going to cry.
Right.
But it
And it's, I
was
mean,
bizarre.
it's bizarre. Clearly, there's some personality issues involved here, but he is one of the great anti-Semites of our time right now. So that's,
Turns out.
that's definitely celebrate Kanye West anti-Semitism. Lahav.
Anyway, one question that I was surprised to hear Chuck Todd ask, because it is something that I think people care about in Israel, is that he asked about changes to the law of return, because basically all of Netanyahu's coalition partners want to change the law of return so that you can't make aliyah, you can't automatically immigrate to Israel if you have one Jewish grandparent. And I don't know specifically how many of the immigrants from Russia and Ukraine only have one Jewish grandparent, but almost three quarters of them are not Jewish according to like Orthodox standards of what's Jewish. So that's like what they're trying to quote unquote fix.
Right.
And then Netanyahu responded that he doesn't think it's going to happen. He's going to try to stop it or something like that, which was sort of like he didn't sound too sure he was going to stop it. And on the other hand, he's probably right not to be too sure he's going to stop it because like. My whole thing is like there's a lot of people who are like, no, Netanyahu is not like illiberal, and Netanyahu is too smart to do these things. And I don't necessarily disagree that his instinct is like not to want to do any of these things. But when you have to keep a coalition together, you can't say no to everything. So like, what is he going to say yes to?
Well, I mean, he's already said yes to a lot, right? He's basically
Well.
outsourcing the entire government, right? And cutting it up into like a small little pizza pie and giving away half and quarter slices to anyone who demands it, which goes to speak in my concern is just more the state of mind of what is he exactly, where is he in terms of giving all this stuff away from the education part to Avi Mo'oz to the head of the civil administration to the finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, to doing a rotation in the finance ministry between Smotrich and Dery, who are two completely different views of economic policy. And it just takes about a year or two to can actually get the ball rolling on economic policy. And I, speaking of that, I'm now in the middle of Netanyahu's book, and he goes through this whole thing
Oh,
of
yeah.
explaining why he voted in favor of the disengagement in three or four occasions until he finally quit. And the reason is because he had to push through, this was the explanation that he gave, he had to push through economic policy. And if he were to vote against the disengagement from Gaza in 2005, he would have been kicked out of the government and all his economic reforms would have gone down the drain. So someone who recognizes the value in these economic and economic policy was willing to pay a political price and vote for something that he claims was he was ideologically opposed to, the i.e. the Gaza disengagement. How could he do stuff like this? So I think that this is really, it just goes to show what I think we all kind of know, but no one, he's never said, which is he doesn't really care so much about that anymore. He cares more about the first priority, which is how do I escape the trial that's ongoing against me, right? And that's the number
Yeah.
one priority.
It was also a few years ago, Amit Segal, who's like one of the top political reporters in Israel on Channel 12, he did a whole series on Netanyahu's life. And one of the like conclusions, I would say relatively novel conclusions that Amit Segal reached was that as much as Netanyahu cares about economic policy, he came to realize that it's politically toxic. And so he tries to sort of throw the hot potato to someone else who can get the political blame. And that's very clearly what he's doing right now.
Right. Lahav, I do want to ask you a question about the U.S. administration. So we heard Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, say the other day that the U.S. will be judging the new government based on policies, not based on its members. Ambassador Tom Nides, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, has spoken a bit over the past few days and basically, sent a similar message, but actually came out in favor of the gay pride parade, which he said he marched in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv last year, and he plans to march in the coming year as well, kind of setting maybe a red line, don't touch this. But what do you think will be potentially the catalyst that could lead to this train wreck of or collision between Israel and the United States with the new government?
Well, first of all, like while recognizing the irony, because we just talked about Avi Mo'oz for 5 minutes, but
Right.
I do think that Blinken was wise to say that. And he said it in front of, he said it at J-Street, which is an audience that would be potentially hostile to that message. So good for him. But look, I actually think something that you were mentioned, you mentioned Netanyahu sort of slicing up ministries and giving these narrow little fiefdoms to outside of the normal ministry. I think the issue is going to be that the Kogat, the sort of like governance of the military government of Judea and Samaria, is going to be in control of the Religious Zionist Party. There's going to be like a minister within the defense ministry,
mm-hmm.
Who's going to be specifically in charge of that issue. And it's going to be someone from Smotrich's party. I think that's where it's going to start. I don't think, to be honest, I just don't think that there are such big changes on LGBT things that are going to happen so quickly. The Jerusalem Pride Parade is something that happened because of, I mean, it's something that happens every year because of a Supreme Court ruling. And so by the time they would have to do all these judicial reforms that they want to do, but right. also I just don't think they're going to get that instantly. I think that'll take time. So I think the first clash is going to be settlements. And I think that that will happen fast.
And that will happen fast. And I mean, we saw, for example, the op-ed that was written by Daniel Kurtzer and Aaron David Miller, two Jewish former members of different administrations. Kurtzer was the ambassador to Israel during the Clinton period, and Miller was part of the peace team at the time in the State Department, who basically said, you know, if Israel does malign activities in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, America should stop selling offensive weapons to Israel. I mean, is that something that do you see that that's really something that could happen?
Look, my take on, I don't want to make it personal, but I think that there are certain people who have not been in these administrations for a really long time, but then they talk with the authority of someone who is. And I think, like, these are people specifically who have been saying the same things for like 30 years. And so I think they're met in Jerusalem mostly with rolled eyes. Let's start with that. And
well, but the question is not how they're met in Jerusalem. It's how they're met in Washington.
Right. But I don't think like, I think right now, I mean, look at what happened with the Iron Dome vote, right? I mean, that's not an offensive weapon. That's a defensive weapon. But still, it came out to, what was it, like 450-9, right? And there's like a few more of those like squad adjacent Congress, members of Congress now, I think, but not like a significantly more. And I think that that's still viewed as a position that's like very extreme on Israel. And I don't see a real shift on that. There was a whole discussion this week of Democrats, I think it was just senators, but with like you know, the big mainstream Jewish organizations, and it was like led by Amy Klobuchar, and they said the normal regular pro-Israel things while also expressing a concern about this government, but they were definitely not threatening you know, weapons sales that I saw.
Right.
So
hopefully that will never happen.
That's on the table,
right? Hopefully that won't happen. Yeah. But you know, policies could potentially lead to that. And my whole thing on this, and by the way, on this issue, is kind of like more along the lines of, this was the government elected in Israel. This was the government that the Israeli people chose. This is the government that Netanyahu has chosen to establish and to give these different types of people these portfolios. And if that does lead to some sort of collision with the US, then, I mean, there might be a price to pay, right? We can't expect
Absolutely.
That people will support Israel no matter what, right? That's the one thing that I push back on, is like, there are some people who say, no matter what, America needs to support Israel. They don't, right? America has its values and its worldview. Israel wants to do something different. That's fine. But Israel should just know that there might be a consequence for it.
Look, we've gone through things like this with Reagan and with George Bush Sr. And you know, whatever, certainly Carter. And in the subsequent decades, it became, I think, in some ways more politically toxic to be seen to be threatening Israel. But I mean, we had this with Obama as well. It's something that Netanyahu and whoever he chooses to be foreign minister, but mainly Netanyahu, is going to have to navigate.
Right.
And hopefully he'll be able to do that. But I think what Blinken said is encouraging, because I think you shouldn't be judging. And I think that that's the standard of the U.S. in other countries as well, that you don't judge based on the person, you judge based on the policies.
Well,
and so we'll have to see.
Based on declared policies, though, that's not a good...
Right,
not,
but the thing is, and I wanted to say this... I know, but I wanted to say this earlier as well, is that like, there are always a lot of things in coalition agreements that don't actually happen. I mean, frankly, like in 2015, I think it was, or the coalition agreement said didn't have a two-state solution in it. And the left flipped out over that, which I was like, why is this surprising to you? But whatever. And then Netanyahu agreed to a two-state solution under Trump. So that's
right.
Just like one example. But a lot of the intentions are, let's say, transformative. But what will actually happen remains to be seen. And I doubt that they'll be able to do half of it.
Maybe I'll just say I hope you're right. But before we turn to our guest, who you had an interview with this week, did you know, Lahav, that the Iranian government, is a member of an international body called the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women, which is dedicated to promoting gender equality and women's empowerment? I mean, what?
Yeah.
What?
The UN is a crazy place. I mean, it was like Libya used to be the head of the Human Rights Council. The UN is crazy. It's like Wonderland, through the looking glass. It
I mean,
just
but like,
doesn't
this
make
is
any
insane. These
sense.
are the Iranians are shooting women, right? And like,
I
because they're
know,
taking off a head covering
for
and
not covering
they're
their
on
hair, yeah.
this is crazy. This is
Yeah.
crazy.
Yeah, so the US wants to remove them from it next. There's a vote next week. But you know what? Like, there's a good chance that that the US could lose the vote because it's one country, one vote, and there's like the whole, I don't know, anti-colonial, anti-Western vibe there. So I'm not optimistic that they're going to get off this committee, but honestly, even if they were, it wouldn't change that much. Like right now, a lot of the world media is running with this story that like the modesty police had been canceled and they're not going to prosecute people for removing headscarves. But like Iran themselves is denying that. And I just am like, why are you publishing this story if they're denying it? Like it just doesn't make any sense. So Iran gets off easy.
Speaking of the UN, you wrote a story this week of how Israel might sanction two UN envoys to Israel because
Yeah, I mean,
they've.
I think people took the word sanction at its like most extreme definition. They're not going to like freeze their bank accounts or anything. They
Right,
don't
but
have that
won't allow
power,
them
but
necessarily free travel throughout the country and things like that.
correct,
Right.
exactly.
And what was this for? This is Tor Wennesland, who's a Norwegian diplomat who serves as the coordinator for Middle East peace process, and then another, Francesca Albanese, who is the
Yeah.
special rapporteur for the occupied Palestinian territories.
Right, so there's two different things. So Tor Wennesland, right, he's supposed to coordinate between the Palestinians and Israel and other related parties. His predecessor, Nikolai Mladenov, who's a Bulgarian diplomat, was really beloved, actually, and he often played a really significant role whenever there was, flare-ups with Hamas in Gaza and things like that. Like he, got along well with Israel. And again, these are all Netanyahu governments, basically, not people who are like predisposed to liking the UN. But his replacement, Tor Wennesland, keeps putting his foot in his mouth, let's say. Last weekend, there was this incident in which three Palestinian men tried to grab a gun. People have also reported that he tried to carjack
Yes.
Israelis. I think that part's not on video, but you could see on video that these Palestinian men tried to grab a policeman's gun, and then not managing that, they stabbed the policeman in the face, which you could reasonably assume they were aiming for his neck. And then the policeman shot the guy and killed him. And Wennesland's reaction to that was horrified by today's killing of a Palestinian man during a scuffle with an Israeli soldier. My condolences to his bereaved family.
Scuffle.
Yes. And also, such incidents must be fully and promptly investigated. Like, actually, I think in Israel, that policeman's going to be told that he acted like with valor. Because if somebody's coming running around with a knife,
Scuffle's like
yeah.
a schoolyard, kind of push, he pushed me, I pushed him type of thing.
Right.
Definitely not good. But you have a great interview with Hillel Neuer to discuss all about the wonderful UN.
Yes. The through the looking glass, the bizarro world of the UN.
Hillel Neuer
I'm
is the
Hillel Neuer of UN Watch.
of UN Watch. So here we go.
So, Hillel Neuer, you are calling in from Geneva, where you often make your presence at the different UN institutions there. What is the latest going on when it comes to Israel at the UN?
Well, there's so many things going on. So to be honest, it's hard to keep track. In New York, there were the annual resolutions of the General Assembly have pretty much been adopted. There's a few of them need to be ratified a second time. in the next week or so. But there's in the General Assembly, which is the parliament of the United Nations, they've adopted 15 resolutions on Israel and about 13 on the rest of the world combined, meaning one on Syria, one on Iran, one on North Korea, a whole bunch on Russia, about six on Russia and Ukraine, but then 15 on Israel. So more on Israel than Iran, Syria, North Korea combined.
What's new there from what I saw is that is this Nakba Day event, right? That they're going to celebrate 75 years of the quote unquote catastrophe of Israel's establishment.
That's right. In May, when Israel will be celebrating its 75th anniversary at the United Nations because of the resolution that was just adopted, they will be commemorating the Nakba, the catastrophe. And of course, it's a repulsive thing to do, but it's also ironic because it was the United Nations that voted in 1947. There was a street in Jerusalem called Kaftet B'November, the 29th of November. In Israel, they celebrate the date when the United Nations General Assembly voted to create a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Arabs went to war immediately, and the Jews danced in the street and celebrated and went ahead and created the Jewish state that the UN endorsed. So for the UN, some 75 years later, to call the creation of Israel a catastrophe and to commemorate it, to endorse the Palestinian rejectionist narrative is ironic, to say the least, and frankly, it's an abomination.
So another thing that's been going on lately, it's been going on forever, but also lately, you could describe a lot of what's happening in the UN that way, is that you have two different sort of UN envoys to the region that have taken to Twitter and to other forums to say things that Israel has found, I guess you could say, deeply offensive. So on the day that we're speaking, the foreign ministry summoned Tor Wennesland, who's like the special envoy for Middle East peace, because he when there was a terrorist attack over the weekend, an attempted carjacking of Israelis, and then when that didn't work, the Palestinian man stabbed the policeman who was trying to stop him. He sent his condolences to the family of the terrorist who the policeman shot, and said the policeman should be investigated. And Israel was like, this was a carjacking and a stabbing. What are you talking about? And then we also have the special rapporteur, Francesca Albanese, who said last week at a conference, I think she over video link spoke at a conference in Gaza, and she said that the Palestinians basically have the right to be violent against Israelis. Why is the UN incapable of hiring people for these positions who are able to take, let's say, even neutral positions, let alone ones that are not sympathizing with Palestinian terrorists?
Well, look, you've rightly identified two highly offensive and inflammatory actions by UN officials. We should distinguish between the two. You asked, you know, why is it that the UN is hiring such people? So it's important to distinguish between the two. The first, whom you mentioned, Tor Wennesland, who is the UN special envoy on Middle East peace, the special coordinator for the Middle East peace process, he is someone who in the past has been able to be somewhat objective and has from time to time condemned Hamas rockets and Hamas terrorism. So I would say that his statement is in some ways even more disappointing, where he rushed to condemn Israel for killing an attacker, for killing a terrorist. So that was very disturbing. And as I said, in particular, because, you know, I'm just looking on his Twitter feed right now, on November 23rd, he condemned terrorist attacks in Jerusalem. These were, I believe, the bus bombings at the bus stops. So his appointment is disturbing, and it's a combination of the individual involved, but also the office. Some of his statements would be drafted by people based in his office in Jerusalem, and many of the people who work there are biased against Israel. So there definitely is a deep institutional bias, and it could be in this instance he was very poorly informed. And if that's the case, well, number one, he should apologize. He should delete the tweet where it's still up from December 2nd, where he says he's horrified by the killing of a Palestinian, Amar Mifle, during a scuffle And as you, Lahav, rightly said, this gentleman was trying to commit a terrorist attack, and he was stopped. So so that's Tor Wennesland. And the other person you mentioned is kind of a, I wouldn't say a special case, but is in a category of extreme haters of Israel, which have typically occupied the position that she had. She's been named by the Human Rights Council. That is a political body based here in Geneva, where I am. It's a 47-nation body. About 70% of the members are either outright dictatorships or some kind of authoritarian regime, rated as either not free or partly free. Partly free are countries like Pakistan that support the Taliban and that allow acid attacks against women. So these are 70% of the members of the Human Rights Council. The anti-Israel majority is very firm. And institutionally, even the secretariat, we revealed a few weeks ago that my organization, UN Watch, is being targeted by the head of the bureaucracy, the chief of the secretariat, whose name is Eric Tistunen. He's a French national. He's been there for well over 25 years. He's sort of running things behind the scenes at the Human Rights Council. And for a variety of reasons, including because we dare to speak out against the bigotry against Israel, he supports that privately, but we know from someone who worked for him. And he instructs his staff to remove my organization's name from the speakers list. So if we sign up to speak, he's removing our name. He's instructed his staff not to stop time. Normally they pause time when we get interrupted by the Cubans or other dictatorships in the middle of a speech. When it comes to UN Watch, he says, don't stop time. He tells his staff, Lahav, to go on the internet and smear me with negative information on the internet, and imagines ways that I could be arrested by UN security. So
right. And
this
you got
is,
it, copies of emails about this, right? If I remember correctly.
Leaked emails that were sent to me in a brown envelope from members of his staff. So some members of his staff have a conscience and found it to be so offensive that they actually sent me emails that he was sending to the entire staff. And we have testimony from a whistleblower named Emma Riley, who was in charge of, worked for him and was in charge of liaison with NGOs. So she testified how he would persecute us systematically. So I mentioned that just to give a sense of how it's not only the member states, but it's even the head of the secretariat, who's very influential behind the scenes, who might be giving a short list of names of whom to appoint and so forth. So it is a deep-seated discrimination against Israel, a hatred against Israel. And Francesca Albanese, that's the special rapporteur, she is now the new rapporteur. She was appointed in March, and she was on the rules, on the books, they're supposed to be impartial. It says they're obliged to be impartial and objective, and they're asked on the application. And she is the least impartial person one could imagine. I you know, you could ask her allies, groups like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, which de facto are her allies, could they imagine a person who was more biased than her? I haven't seen such a person. She is someone who, before she was appointed, routinely compares the situation of the Palestinians to victims of the Nazi Holocaust. So she is effectively, repeatedly, has compared the Nakba, the Palestinian experience in 1948, with the Holocaust. When these large NGOs like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch falsely accused Israel of apartheid, she was elated. She was interviewed in Italian and she said, liberata di parola, they've liberated the word. She looked to the skies in elation, in ecstasy. They've liberated the word. So she now has been appointed since approximately April or so. And she accuses Israel of apartheid. And as you mentioned in a recent conference, which was a Hamas conference, according to Press TV, the organization that hosted it is a Hamas organization. She addressed the event. So that is, you know, offensive action number one, that a UN rapporteur for human rights would be speaking at an event organized by a terrorist group that openly murders children and celebrates that. And secondly, she is quoted as having said, you have the right to resist. And she denied having said that, but in her tweets, she says that. And when you tell Hamas or Palestinians, you have the right to resist, they don't mean putting up a sign and, you know, like in China where they have a blank sign standing at a street corner. For Palestinians, resistance means bombing Israeli women and children on buses. They say that this is resistance. So this is Francesca Albanese. And the reason she was appointed is because the majority that's there, but also the institution, many of the actors beyond just the member states, support this demonization of Israel.
So let's zoom in really on the Human Rights Council, because it's I mean, even before you had this head of the secretariat that you talked about, like it seems like a institution that's just structurally biased against Israel, but also just really structurally biased against wrapping most authoritarian regimes in the world for their actual human rights violations. I mean, you end up having, like you said, you know, very few democratic countries actually on the, you know, on the council as compared to others. So how did it get to be that way?
Well, you know, let's take a look. The members today of the Human Rights Council, just to give folks some examples, include today, it's the highest human rights body at the United Nations. They include China, Cuba, Pakistan, Libya, Eritrea, Venezuela. Russia was a member for many years. They were suspended thanks to a campaign that we spearheaded, which the U.S. took up earlier this year in wake of the invasion of Ukraine. And, you know, Kazakhstan is a member, and the list goes on. How did it get to be this way? Look, let's look back at how it began. Eleanor Roosevelt was the founding chair in 1946. When it began, the members were actually individuals, sort of idealistic, eminent individuals. And very quickly, the UN made it government representatives. And then what you basically had is that as the Human Rights Commission, as it was originally known until 2006, it originally did not have very much power, but over time it began to acquire more tools in its toolbox, including the ability to name and shame. This began, I would say, in the 70s and 80s. And as it acquired the power to name and shame, the worst dictatorships wanted to make sure that they could defend themselves, shield their abuses, their record of abuses from scrutiny, and the records of their allies. And so these dictatorships began to run for office and were willing to trade whatever was necessary in economic capital, political capital, to make sure they get elected. So when there are elections today, what's now known as the Human Rights Council, the reason that China, Cuba, Eritrea, Pakistan, Libya get elected is because when it's time to put forward candidacies, they will go before their regional group and they'll say, look, we're running, and we don't want you to run. And anyone can run. So in Latin America, you know, 15 countries can run. But in the end, only a handful run for the handful of seats, because the UN is a very corrupt place where deals are done behind the scenes, under the table, and they don't like competition. So the Cubans will tell the others, look, don't run. And they'll tell, I don't know, the Colombians or the Uruguayans, you know, don't run. We're going to run, and, you know, we'll give you something. Or if you mess with us, we'll make life hard for you. So through carrots and sticks, these dictatorships are willing to trade a lot to get there. Whereas if you are, you know, if you are some small country that is not committing gross human rights abuses, you would like to be there, but you don't need to be there. And, you know, the Chinese want to be there, the Cubans want to be there, the Venezuelans want to be there. So they're willing to trade enough or intimidate others enough to make sure they get the seats. And sadly, there is a majority that is willing to vote for them very often. And we'll sort of sometimes go along as sheep. If there's three available seats and only three candidates, they're not obliged to vote for any of these countries. Every country needs to be affirmatively elected by at least, you know, 96, 97 members. And sadly, when there is no competition, the General Assembly will just vote for whatever names are there. So it's a very sad situation when it comes to elections.
So the U.S. has gone kind of back and forth on the Human Rights Council. Right now they're on it. Other times they've said, no, we don't want to be part of this den of iniquity. What do you think is better for them to be there, to at least voice, you know, have a voice of democracy, or do you think that them being there is sort of legitimizing the terrible things they do?
I think that if the institution is not going away, so we had an experiment in 2006 to 2009, That's the first time that the U.S. left this den of iniquity. And in many cases, it is. From time to time, they can do the right thing. But very often, it is a den of iniquity. And the U.S. left under George W. Bush and John Bolton being ambassador in New York to the U.N. And they pulled out. And I was here. That's when they made this supposed reform from the commission to the council. And it didn't get better. And I would say it got much worse. The U.S. was typically the leader of anything good that was happening and leader in resisting the bad things. And when they left the room, it was reminded me when I was a kid, when the teacher would leave the classroom when we were in elementary school and, you know, kids would start throwing chalk and there'd be kind of chaos. And that's kind of what the Human Rights Council looked like. I remember Pakistan and Egypt suddenly were taking the lead on things. European countries were a bit confused. They didn't know what they should be doing. They didn't know how to take the offense. So it didn't get better. It got worse. And it didn't go away. So maybe in American circles, maybe they talked about it a bit less, but the Human Rights Council adopts resolutions, they create experts, they produce reports, they send them to The Hague, they get quoted around the world. So like it or not, the Human Rights Council influences the hearts and minds of hundreds of millions of people. So staying away, in the American mind or in conservative circles, it may be satisfied they have not given it legitimacy, but it's not going away. So we ideally would like the U.S. to be there to speak out, go on the record, fight for what is right. The same way U.S. ambassadors do so in the General Assembly, even if they're in the minority at times, we'd like to see them do it here. Now, the question is, when the U.S. does engage, are they doing the right thing? So the Biden administration rejoined because Trump pulled out. The Biden administration rejoined, and I give them credit for doing a number of good things. They did try to do a resolution on China, didn't win, have a discussion on the Uyghurs of Xinjiang, just to have a discussion. It failed, but I'm glad that they brought it to a vote. So that happened recently in the September-October session. And then the U.S. in June, Ambassador Michelle Taylor led a joint statement to call out the absurd commission of inquiry, which is headed by an anti-Israel bigot, Navi Pillay, who signs petitions to sanction apartheid Israel, even as she's sitting on this commission as the judge. It's ridiculous.
Another person who's supposed to be impartial.
Supposed to be impartial. One of the members, Maloun Kotari, rants about the Jewish lobby and dreams of Israel being kicked out of the UN. And he's another member who was condemned by 18 countries and UN officials for his anti-Semitism. So do I thank the US for leading a statement against the Commission of Inquiry? So the U.S. has done a number of good things. Sometimes my critique of the administration is that they often praise the Human Rights Council and they do in that way legitimize it. I hope that we've made a request to the Secretary General to investigate this UN official who's trying to censor and intimidate and target and harass our organization, this guy Eric Testunet. I hope the United States will speak out. They have not spoken out yet on this. I hope they will. For me, the test for the U.S. is to be there and fight for what is right, to defend human rights victims and to defend organizations, human rights organizations that speak out for justice. And so if we're being censored and intimidated, we need the U.S. to speak out. I hope that they will. And I believe that the U.S. can certainly take, even in this, in sort of the dark ages of the Human Rights Council, the U.S. can be the defenders of civilization. And if they do so, I think they can definitely justify their presence there. But the proof has to be in the pudding, and we'll see what the U.S. record will be.
So we mentioned this sort of in my discussion with Yaakov, that the U.S. is now pushing to remove Iran from the Commission on the Status of Women, which is, I mean, anyone who knows anything about Iran knows they probably shouldn't have been there in the first place, but it's sort of at least this, I guess you could say, symbolic move in response to the protests in Iran that are really, you know, about oppression of women. What else do you see going on when it comes to Iran? Is there anything resembling a satisfactory response?
Well, it's mixed. I'm not sure if the UN response is satisfactory, but we can acknowledge the good things and tell you what's missing. So, you know, things that have happened and that are up ahead. So about 2 weeks ago, we had the first ever special session at the Human Rights Council on human rights abuses in Iran. So that was a very good thing. We've been calling for it for over a decade. 13 years ago, we brought human rights activist Nazanin Afshinjam together with former political prisoner Ahmad Batebi. They came on behalf of 50 Iranian activists, demanded before the UN to have a special session, and they were ignored. We sent written statements and we've been calling for it, and it was ignored. And it should have happened years ago, because the crimes that are happening now are not new. It's the awakening is new, and the world support is new. But the crimes, as you know, the president is someone who oversaw the execution of thousands, you know, decades ago. So we're glad there was a special session at the Human Rights Council. I was there. There was a large majority. Germany took the lead in calling for that session. I salute Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock. She came to Geneva. She spoke. And they got, I think the vote was 25-6. So it was an overwhelming majority. And it shows that when democracies are really willing to fight, they can, they can limit the opposition on certain things. They couldn't get it on Xinjiang because China's too powerful. But on a number of things, you know, they suspended Russia. People said that was going to be hard. I said, it's not going to be hard. You're going to get a lot of abstentions. And they did. The numbers were something like 80 or 90 to 25. And it was well more than what was needed to remove Russia from the Human Rights Council. So now we have a special session. They created a fact-finding mission into the abuses in Iran. And we'll hear from them sometime next year. It won't be immediate, but we're glad that was created. Up ahead, as you indicated, Lahav next week on Wednesday, December 14th. This is quite interesting because the Commission on the Status of Women, which is the UN Women's Rights Commission, basically, as you mentioned, Iran is a member. And when they were elected in April 2021, there was silence. No one talked about it. There was no statement by the United States or the European Union or organizations, Amnesty, Human Rights Watch. No one said a thing. We were the first to expose it. We were the first to call it out, to say how absurd this was, how Orwellian, that the regime that subjugates women, that beats women's rights activists, that tortures them, that rapes them, that imprisons them, that in the past few months is shooting them on the streets, that they would be a judge on women's rights at the UN is obscene. It's an abomination. So we had a firestorm in parliaments initially, but then there was kind of quiet. Now there's finally the US changed position. You know, Matt Lee of the Associated Press, he challenged the US State Department spokesman, Ned Price, back in April 2021. He said, what is the US position? And the State Department spokesman hemmed and hawed. He didn't want to address it a year and a half ago. He said, well, we don't like when bad countries join, but he would not directly, explicitly condemn Iran's election. Fast forward to today, and we have Kamala Harris tweeting saying we need to remove Iran. The US called this meeting next week of the Economic and Social Council, a 54-nation body, and they submitted a resolution. We had drafted a resolution about 2 months ago, and the US, you know, picked up on that and put in a text. So I think it's wonderful. I have to say that it's never happened before. So unlike the Human Rights Council, where there is a provision in Article 8 of the Charter of the Human Rights Council, which contemplates suspending members that commit gross and systematic abuses, the UN Commission on the Status of Women has no provision. There is no provision to suspend a country. So this is new territory. We said it could be done. We drafted a resolution. The parent body, which is the Economic and Social Council, they're the ones that elected Iran, shamefully. They're the ones, we argued, and the US agrees, that have the power to remove them. So big question on what the vote will be like next week. I would like to see an overwhelming vote. Remains to be seen. EU countries are not loving this action by the US. It interferes with their way of doing business at the UN, which is kind of turning a blind eye to dictatorships getting elected. The Dutch foreign minister pushed back in a letter to the parliament about a week or two ago, gave three reasons why they should not support removing Iran. He got called out by their House of Representatives, by their lower house, and he kind of backed down. But I've not seen a single statement by any EU foreign minister or president or prime minister about this. There have been motions adopted by the Dutch Senate and lower house, motion adopted in the French National Assembly, but I haven't seen any government speak out. So I think they're going to have to vote with the Americans and vote yes, but they're not eager about it. And so I'm concerned about some of the non-EU countries, countries in Africa and Asia, South America. How are they going to vote? So we're lobbying intensively to make sure there is a strong majority on December 14th. going forward, you know, Security Council has not taken any action on this.
Yeah,
it's going to be very hard to see anything given Russia and China can veto any action. The General Assembly has not called a special session. They've done many against Israel. They did finally some on Russia this year, on Ukraine. General Assembly should call a special session. UN experts should be speaking out. We do not hear enough from the UN human rights experts here in Geneva. There's 55 of them. On other issues, issues that you know about, they're rushing to issue statements. There have been some on Iran. There have been some, and I give them credit for
it's
that.
It's amazing
but how, not enough.
How Iran has this like almost immunity. I mean, they're not like China, I could see, right? China's doing horrible things to the Uyghurs, but they're one of the most powerful countries in the world. They really have leverage over so many other countries. But Iran, like how is Iran getting immunity, sort of almost immunity at the UN?
Well, they don't have immunity. And I'd say, you know, until now we had very modest, I'll qualify that. We have a strong annual resolution for many years introduced by my country, Canada, at the General Assembly. And that's a strong resolution, and they introduced it again. It documents Iran's abuses. So that's something good. In Geneva, we used to have we have had an annual resolution, very weak text. The sponsors like Sweden would say it's a short procedural text. The main thing of the text would be to renew the mandate of an investigator, a special rapporteur. So we had a special rapporteur in Iran. We had certain things, but there was never any strong, enthusiastic, energetic action on Iran. We had the special session now, and I think, Lahav, the answer really is the democracies didn't push for strong action. So there were things they were doing in New York. There were things in Geneva, but never robust action that really shows that the world cares. And it turns out when the democracy stood up to the plate, Germany with its support of the other democracies, they were able to make it happen. So whatever immunity does exist is because the democracies are not pushing for it. And we just saw the American Secretary of State the other day, Tony Blinken, said, we want Iran to negotiate the nuclear deal. So they still want to negotiate with this regime that's massacring people on the streets. So I think our democracies are confused. Our democracies are confused. They're not ready to really go, you know, to the max on Iran. And so the countries like Nepal or Singapore or, I don't know, Peru, what do you expect from them? If they don't see the lead coming from America, London, Paris, Berlin, you're not going to get other countries that are kind of weaker. So Iran does not have immunity, but there is a lack of passion. Again, the human rights experts have done a few statements. They did support a special session, but you're not seeing the energy, excitement that you saw in other things. I'll just give you one example. The head of Amnesty International today is a woman named Agnès Callamard. She's a French national. Prior to joining Amnesty a little over a year ago, she was the UN special rapporteur on assassinations. And when Khashoggi was killed, the Saudi journalist was living in America, when he was killed, she, I'll say two things. When Soleimani was killed by the Americans, who was a terrorist mastermind general of the IRGC, she immediately condemned his killing and spent many months focusing on his killing. So the killing of an Iranian regime mastermind terrorist who helped oversee the killing of hundreds of thousands in Syria and other places around the Middle East. And she spent enormous amount of time writing reports about how his killing was illegal. And she was endorsed by Iran. She did not spend an enormous amount of time looking into Iran's assassinations in Europe and within Iran. She criticized Iran from time to time, but there was no energy for it. And why there is an energy on some things and not another is an interesting question.
So going back to something you had said earlier, just to wrap up and bring things back to Israel, you had mentioned the Netherlands and France, for example, countries that, you know, oppose the way Iran treats women, but then their behavior is different in the UN. When we look at Israel, I mean, Israel's foreign relations are flourishing. Israel's ties with more countries than ever before. And, you know, in general, I think we're doing pretty well in the world. But in the UN, it's as if it's, I don't know what, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and that nothing has changed. What what can be done about that? What do you think Israel should be doing? And what do you think organizations like yours are doing or should be doing?
Look, you've put the finger on a very interesting phenomenon. Indeed, in the past, I would say two decades, perhaps more, Israel's bilateral relations have improved dramatically with many countries. Israel has stronger relations and more diplomatic relations with more countries than ever before. Whether it's in Africa, you know, diplomatic relations that are better than ever before, with more countries than ever before, and with Asia, important countries like China, they're terrible human rights abuser. But you know, from Israel's bilateral perspective, every country has relations with China, and Israel has good relations with China, and better than ever before. And I would say before the war in Ukraine, with Russia and with important regional powers, and of course in the Middle East with the Abraham Accords, with the Emirates, Bahrain, Morocco, and so forth. And yet you do not see that manifest typically in UN votes. And you know, why is that the case? Well, if you would go, for example, to, I don't know, Bahrain or the Emirates, and you would say to them, you embrace us so warmly. Our president Herzog is visiting Bahrain and has the national anthem, the Hatikva, played by the Bahraini military band and so many other ways. Why is it that you vote against us all the time at the UN? In such a conversation, the Gulf states could respond, look, you know, what do you want from us? You have great relations with Singapore. You maybe helped train their army years ago and have wonderful relations there, but they always vote against you at the UN. What do you want from us? We're an Arab Muslim country. We just signed on to relations with you a couple of years ago. We still have constituencies who like these resolutions. So I think the answer is complex. You know, why would a country like Singapore vote against Israel almost all the time? They would probably tell you, look, we're under pressure. We're under pressure from our own Muslim population. We're next to Malaysia, where there's, you know, tens of millions of Muslims who hate Israel. We have still various Arab and Islamic countries that support the singling out of Israel, Palestinian cause. It still is, for many countries, a political liability to stand with Israel. And so many countries have this cognitive dissonance where they have great relations bilaterally, but in terms of what they're publicly willing to vote for, and it is significant, you could say they're symbolic, but it's a register of what countries are willing to, what positions they're willing to take for the world to see and for their own populations to see. And the facts are that a large majority of countries are still afraid to stand with Israel when it's being singled out. And you'd have to look at each country to pick apart the forces at play, but I think it'd be a combination of domestic considerations. You know, the EU is the EU voting against Israel in 2/3 of the resolutions because of their pressure by Arab and Islamic states, maybe, but probably also because large parts of the EU, you know, European societies don't like Israel and have very negative stereotypes against the Jewish state. So I think in each country, you'll find a combination of domestic factors and international pressure from Arab and Islamic states. And the combination is that the Jewish state is still not popular in certain ways, even though for realpolitik and other reasons, they are willing to develop very strong bilateral relations with Israel.
All right. Hillel Neuer, Executive Director of UN Watch, thank you so much for being on the podcast this week. It's been very interesting.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Jerusalem Post podcast. If you enjoyed it, please send it to your friends and family. They can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, wherever you like to listen to podcasts. And as always, we'll be back next week.